From Lakeshore Public Radio, this is Regionally Speaking. I'm Chris Nolte. The NFIB Small Business Optimism Index is out, and let's find out what the impact is on Hoosier small businesses. We have with us the director of Indiana's small business operation. We have the director of the NFIB Indiana with us, Barbara Quant. And Barbara, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thank you, Chris. So good to talk with you again.
Well, looks like the latest index shows some optimism, at least on a national basis. How is it for small businesses in Indiana? But what are still the major concerns as they're all trying to still deal with recovering from the pandemic?
Well, it is good news. It is definitely things are improving. And when we first spoke, when the pandemic hit a year ago, things were pretty darn sad for small business. And it's improved in a great deal. This month it rose 2.4 points. That's the optimism index. We do this small business economic trends report every month, and we've been doing it for decades. So it's up 2.4 points to 98.2. And as you know, the optimism index cratered in the last year. So this is excellent news.
Fill us in, if you will, on some of the concerns that are still out there. And the report, I guess, the latest report that's out, bears a lot of these out, about especially about small businesses that may be open for business, but they're having trouble trying to find people to run them.
Yes, yes. The good news needs to be tempered with an increasingly disturbing trend that we're seeing. 42% of small business owners, and this is a new record number here, 42% reported job openings they could not fill, that they can't find qualified workers. And this is serious. Small business has led us out of every recession. And if they can't find qualified workers to fill the jobs that they are creating, then the economy, not only the small business economy, but the entire national economy could falter.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's right, because they're basically the cornerstone. They're the basis that the bigger companies can help grow on as well. But not to mention all the dozens and hundreds of mom and pop operations, so to speak, in Indiana and other states.
Yes, it small businesses create two-thirds at least of the net new jobs, and this is year in and year out. So if they're not able to create those jobs and fill them and grow, then definitely the economy will become stagnant. And right now we need every job we can get.
Are we noticing, too, that small businesses, and particularly those in Indiana, are still having issues trying to not only find the workers to help keep the operations going, but maybe the capital to help build back up here? And I know that a lot of the businesses had to rely on loans from the federal government.
Yes, and the PPP loan program and the EIDL program were both extremely helpful to small businesses, and the majority of small businesses took advantage of those, and that has worked out very well. But there are a lot of businesses that are still, and of course, restaurants and bars come to mind
right.
Very quickly, because they were just decimated, and some of them are gone forever. And there are just some businesses that can't grow until the economy gets further along here, and so that or come back. So some are gone forever. There are some that are doing very well, and I'll cite Jason Smith of M&M Car Care in Merrillville as an example.
Right.
We had talked about him a year ago, and he was in desperate shape, and mortgaging his house to help keep his business running, and he was doing everything he could to stay alive and keep his people employed. And now he's doing very well. He's growing. He's adding new people. So his experience is a complete opposite of what some folks are feeling.
That's good. We know that the lawmakers in Indianapolis are still in session, and in fact, you've before we had our conversation today, have talked to and had your chance to speak out about some bills that are before committee. What are some of the measures that the NFIB in Indiana is supporting and keeping a very close eye on here in these last days of the General Assembly session?
Well, there have been a number of issues that were have already been passed that were particularly helpful to small business. The first was liability protection from frivolous lawsuits due to COVID-19 allegations. So that passed, and that protects, unless you've been completely paid no attention to protecting people, you can be exempt from being sued from on a frivolous basis. The also there was House Bill 1004, and that it's a small business grant program for those recovering. So there's this is state money that will help small businesses throughout Indiana. And the one that I was attending this morning is Senate Bill 336, which is a small business, it's business personal property tax small business exemption. It's a mouthful. Small businesses have to pay taxes on all their equipment and their furniture. And so what happens is that very often it costs more to process the actual return than the tax that's raised. So the tax is very small, but you have to go through the process of filing it, and the local governments have to process that. And so it's called de minimis for the reason that it's actually a very ridiculous tax because it doesn't really do any good, and it does harm for all these businesses. So it would the bill that was originally passed would exempt an additional 52,000 small businesses. And what we're talking about are the smallest of the small businesses, the mom and pops. So it would help all these folks that we've been talking about that have suffered through this last year, the ones that have done so poorly and are now just trying to get back in business.
We know that the federal government has set on the next wave of funding that will help the state of Indiana in particular, and they'll now be up to the lawmakers to be able to decide how it fits into the next two-year state budget. But what does the NFIB in Indiana have to say about the measure that came out of Washington, now in Indiana, and what kind of help that might be able to provide for small businesses?
Well, one place that could very quickly help small businesses and businesses across the state would be to help shore up the unemployment trust fund. What's happened is we've had to borrow from the federal government. You know, it basically has drained all the money that was in there and more. So we need the money to go into that fund so that small businesses don't have to end up paying extra taxes, because taxes will go up. The fund will if it's broke, taxes will have to go up to restore the fund.
Right.
So it would be most helpful to the economy of Indiana to help put money into the unemployment insurance trust fund.
Well, we'll see what comes about on that, and since the lawmakers and the government in general will have a chance to decide what of the funds are going to be able to go into these programs and help in the recovery from the pandemic, and we'll just have to see what happens in this, and that'll be something in the next, certainly the next months and maybe even years here as the funds are still available to be used. And Barbara, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about the efforts the lawmakers are dealing with and some of the other information, too, coming out of the NFIB Small Business Optimism Index. Thank you for being with us today to talk about it.
Thank you, Chris.
Barbara Quandt is the NFIB state director in Indiana. In late February, some Republican Party lawmakers booed and heckled their Black Democratic counterparts on the House floor. It's a situation that nearly turned physical. Many Black activists and General Assembly members say the incident was indicative of a greater problem, the lack of diversity within the legislature and state politics overall. We have a report on that from Indiana Public Broadcasting's Mitch Leakin.
Boo if you want to.
Please, please, let the member speak. Let the member speak.
I've been elected since 2008. We have had emotional discussions on a lot of issues, but nothing to the level of disrespecting another person.
When Pryor walks the State House halls, she doesn't see many people who look like her. She's a black woman in a building historically dominated by white men.
There is a constant fight to have your voice heard sometimes.
Just 15% of Hoosiers are people of color, making Indiana one of the whiter states in the country. When you compare the state numbers to the demographics of the General Assembly, white Hoosiers are slightly overrepresented. They're 85% of the population and about 89% of legislators. Latino and Asian Hoosiers are underrepresented, while African Americans are about represented proportionally. But members of the state's black caucus say that doesn't mean much when the party in power is almost completely white.
It's only legislation from one perspective alone. It's not public policy from a wide variety of perspectives.
109 of 110 Republican legislators are white. So is every statewide elected official. With the GOP's commanding supermajority in the legislature, minority leaders feel their Republican counterparts often dismiss their concerns.
Until those particular issues arrive in the majority community, and then all of a sudden what we say then becomes relevant.
Indiana didn't have a hate crime law until a synagogue in Carmel was vandalized in 2018. The Black Caucus had been pushing for one for most of the decade. Pryor says having more diverse voices and power would create better legislation for all Hoosiers.
I don't necessarily cast as a problem, but it's certainly something that we need to improve upon.
State Republican Party Chairman Kyle Hupfer says in some cases, GOP policies on issues such as workforce development and child mortality have disproportionately helped some minority communities. The party just needs to do a better job of communicating its successes with them.
We are starting, I think, to take meaningful steps to have authentic conversations and build authentic relationships where I think a path exists for some improvement over the next several years.
It'll be a long game, though. Over 80% of black voters identify as Democrats. And when it comes to Hispanic and Asian voters, the numbers only get slightly better for Republicans.
One thing that I personally and that the party is spending a lot of time is meeting grassroots leaders in these communities on a one-on-one or small group basis and getting a better understanding of their issues.
But members of the Black Caucus say the GOP could show it means business by listening to their concerns at the State House, where they've historically fallen on deaf ears. The General Assembly passed a police reform bill this session, but only after mass demonstrations for racial justice over the summer.
So many issues that affect the minority, and I'll say the African-American community in particular. And when we say this is a problem, this is a crisis, this is how we need to resolve these issues, it's really swept under the rug.
The GOP has hired its first director of diversity and inclusion and began a diversity leadership series to increase engagement and prepare minority Republicans to run for office. But just this week, the party caucused in Evansville to choose a replacement for former Representative Holly Sullivan, the new Secretary of State. The caucus went with local real estate broker Tim O'Brien. Venezuelan immigrant Alfonso Vidal didn't make it past the first round of voting.
It's going to be a process. We didn't get here overnight. It won't change overnight.
For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Mitch Legan.
This time last year, students had been sent home for spring break as the coronavirus had continued to spread, and many never came back to the classroom. At-home learning was a monumental challenge for many, but some families say they managed to find value in the changes that COVID-19 forced onto their lives. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jeannie Lindsay spoke with a group of families to hear what they've gained in a year that was largely defined by loss.
Andrea Maltese remembers the buildup to the pandemic. She just wanted to get it over with.
We're practicing on bringing the iPads home. They had the system set up in school. And I was just sort of thinking, okay, let's call it now. Let's just start shutting down, get ahead of this. And it'll probably just be a couple weeks and things will return to normal.
Her two elementary age kids didn't seem worried. She wasn't either until everything changed.
So I remember we were sitting at the dinner table when all the devices started going off, you know, everybody's phone ringing to say it was just like it usually does on a snow day, but it was that we weren't coming back to school the next day.
In the fall, her kids would continue online learning. They had the resources to do it, and she knew other families might need to send their kids to school. The decision about in-person schooling wasn't clear for everyone. Suzanne Godby-Inglesby almost sent her first grader back, but when she got details, she wasn't convinced.
We were waiting on the district to send the information and waiting to hear what this was going to look like. And when we got it, the class sizes were going to be pretty large and they were still going to be going back and forth and using the cafeteria. And I didn't feel super confident about that.
It hasn't been easy. Godby-Inglesby says she's not sure they've figured out a routine, and it's been a year. But families see more than just challenges. Erica Lee's son doesn't want to go back to school in person, and she sees why. He's used games and technology to customize his work, and his mental health needs have changed. It's been a mixed bag.
He's gotten so much more sleep. He was in therapy for anxiety and was being bullied during recess. And that's all gone away, right? He's had other issues. He's depressed sometimes. He's anxious. He doesn't always want to do what he's supposed to do. And clearly time management issues are going to continue to haunt us. But he has become more independent.
And parents recognize that independence comes with potential benefits. Pam Kukalis likens her son's experience to a sort of trial run for college. She's gained things, too. It's his last year of middle school, and the time they've spent together, she says, has been invaluable.
You know, there was a lot of turmoil going on, so to be able to actually, like, sit and maybe watch some news or look up some news and then talk about it and not feel so frazzled from, you know, being at work or doing something else, just having that sort of time is really been the best thing about this year.
Intense time together during the pandemic means something different for Jessie Wong. Her parents live in China, her daughters are young, and traveling takes a lot of time. After learning they can work from pretty much anywhere, Wong and her husband are making a significant life change.
We've thought about this for a long time and thought if the vaccines are becoming available and our parents are not getting any younger, and it is really hard for us to visit them or for them to visit us. So we finally made the decision of moving to a coastal city on the West Coast where it will be a lot easier to visit families.
And when it comes to the much talked about return to school buildings, whenever that is, some are more apprehensive than others. The challenges and benefits of a year online are different for everybody, and there's no guaranteed end date to the pandemic. But these families do have one more thing in common. They're ready to get back some of the kinds of experiences they missed out on in 2020 and just let their kids be kids again. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jeannie Lindsay.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. On Morning Edition, Steve Inskeep had a chance to talk with two members of Congress about a bipartisan effort to boost civics and history education with some money.
Two United States senators came to the phone yesterday. We'd called them to discuss their proposal to commit $1 billion of federal money to civics education. Could I get each of you just to introduce yourself?
I'm Senator Chris Coons from Delaware. And I'm Senator John Cornyn from Texas.
Should we say that introduction again and also say our party, which I forgot to?
Ooh, that might be a good idea.
I'm Senator Chris Coons, a Democrat from Delaware.
And I'm John Cornyn, a Republican from Texas.
Glad they did it again, because the party labels are important here. Senators Cornyn and Coons say they are working on a bipartisan measure. They're doing so in the wake of the attack on the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, among other events. They're proposing grants to support access to civics and history education. Senator Cornyn made his case by quoting historic documents. One was from the Texas Revolution against Mexico, which talked of the importance of education. Another document was Lincoln's Gettysburg Address.
Ours is a government of the people, by the people, or for the people, as Lincoln said, but we can't govern ourselves if we don't have knowledge of our foundational principles or our history.
If we don't train young people in civics and how to participate, then we can't be that surprised when our discourse breaks down.
I guess we should note we're talking about two related but different things here. One is the history of the country, but the other is just how the government works, basic civics. Senators, when you talk with constituents, do you sometimes get the impression that a lot of them really don't understand how the government works, how you can be helpful to them and how you can't be?
occasionally, Steve, I wonder whether some members of Congress know how government works. And, you know, and frequently what I'll do is, and I bet Chris has done the same thing, is I'll say, you remember that old cartoon called Schoolhouse Rock? I'm just a bill on Capitol Hill. If we are the government, we need to know how it works so we can influence it.
How much has civics teaching declined in recent decades?
A lot, Steve. There was a recent editorial in the Wall Street Journal by six former secretaries of education from both parties that stated that we now invest 1,000 times more in STEM education in our schools than we do in civics and history education. Civics education has fallen off in part because of disagreements over what should be taught. But I don't think we can avoid the necessity, the urgency of helping a younger generation learn the basics of how our government works and why compromise is essential.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned those disagreements, because if you start talking about history, Senator Cornyn mentioned Texas's independence from Mexico. That's a story about which you can have many different perspectives. You could have more perspectives about the Confederacy and the Civil War. Under this proposal, what is the government supposed to do when somebody asks for a grant to study the Confederacy in a certain way, say?
Well, I think, you know, part of living in a free society and part of critical thinking is to have those conversations. We're not perfect, and certainly our history reflects that, and there's a lot in our history to be ashamed of, but hopefully to learn from, too.
An important provision in our bill prevents the federal Secretary of Education from establishing a uniform civics or history curriculum for the country. That's a job left to the state.
Should we accept going in, if this bill becomes law, that some of this money is going to go to some study or project or program that a lot of people hate?
Well, so that certainly isn't our intention, but I certainly believe that some of it will go to points of view that I don't agree with and I won't agree with, but I think that's okay too.
I wonder if there are some forces in society that work against anything you might try in the public school system. And the first is just the speed of information at the moment. We're all trained for instant answers. And you two are working in a democratic system that by design is very slow and no fight is ever really over.
Steve, I'm not sure exactly if that's just a question or an observation.
Well, it's a reality, and I'm wondering if it's going to be very difficult for you to fight against that.
You know, this idea that we're going to live our lives without finding somebody or something we disagree with is just a fantasy. And we need to disabuse young people at an early point in their lives that they're going to encounter people different from themselves with different experiences and different points of view. But that's what it means to grow up and to mature and to become more wise and to learn to live together and to try to build consensus rather than just have separate lanes that we all sort of operate or travel in.
I'd like to ask on your reflections about whether you think the public is better informed than it was 4 or 5 years ago. We've been through this period of partisan division and passionate battles that in some ways has almost seemed like a basic civic education. You know, we've worked through impeachments. We've done all kinds of different things. But we also had for several years a president who just constantly misstated how government worked and spread disinformation about his election defeat, for example. Are we better or worse educated than we were a few years ago?
I think frequently what people are asked to do is to pick a side. You know, what's your narrative? You know, somebody once told me in Washington, D.C., the person that has the best narrative wins. And that's not about critical thinking. That's not about respecting different points of view and trying to find common ground.
Steve, we've certainly had more people participate in politics in the last couple of years. We had more people coming out marching and protesting than I've seen at any point in my adult life. We had more people vote in the 2020 presidential election. But a lot of it has been very contentious. And so in some ways, although we are participating more, we are more sharply divided than we've been at any point in my life. And the point of democracy is to both participate and make progress.
Republican Senator John Cornyn of Texas and Democratic Senator Chris Coons of Delaware. Thanks to you both.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Steve. I'm just a
bill. Yes, I'm. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Coming up tomorrow on Reporters Roundtable Thursday, we have from the Times, Chief Political Reporter Dan Carton, as well as Post Tribune freelance reporter Amy LaValle, telling about some of the stories that they put out in print and online in their newspapers, and more coming up on the program tomorrow, and we hope you can join us.